We had talked about this idea really right after the tornado happened in 2013. It was such a significant storm at the time, and being both amateur storm buffs living here in Oklahoma, this was a subject that was on all of our minds. And with that, Brian and I started talking about the idea of creating some type of performance piece. We weren't really sure at the time what it was, but we knew there would be a musical component. We knew there would be a film or footage component because there was so much great footage shot of this storm. The idea really congealed about February of this year when he had moved back to Tulsa from Santa Fe. We were standing out on his back porch. I had asked him, you know, what he was working on, what's inspiring him right now. And he, at the time, was on tour with one of his other bands, Nola Tet. He said that was keeping him busy, but he was looking for inspiration and just open. And we thought of revisiting this idea, the idea that, again, there could be a story behind this weather event, because there were so many things that were special about this particular storm.
Let me ask you guys to describe that day here, May 31st, 2013, the El Reno tornado. What made it different than other tornadoes, and was this the first EF6?
I mean, arguably, it would be the first EF6. Unfortunately, the scale that they use...
The Fujita scale.
Fujita scale, exactly. It doesn't really deal directly with the size of the tornado and the wind speeds. The Fujita scale deals directly with the amount of damage that's found on the ground. And so just based on the records that it broke, most experts and storm chasers would say it was one of the first F6s of all time. It got up to 4.3 miles wide, wind speeds up to 335 miles per hour. The tornado itself was traveling at 55 miles an hour. Many of the storm chasers were in 4- and 6-cylinder vehicles. They couldn't get them over 30 miles an hour. So really, that's where we got our allegory for comparing the monster, you know, comparing this tornado to the monster Grendel, comparing the storm chasers to our archaic hero Beowulf. It's a complex piece, and we're trying to tie a lot of loose ends together.
Well, just real quick, there'd never been another recorded tornado of this magnitude on the planet.
Never.
You're right about that. One of the reasons that it was classified initially, it was classified as an EF3. Because of the lack of damage. The majority of this storm
was out in fields.
Was out in these big fields of Canadian County. And so there wasn't a whole lot of damage sustained. But if this storm had moved into, say, for instance, the OKC Metro, or gone north of I-40 and got into, say, El Reno, Yukon, then the damage would be severe. You know, touching on what Brian said, to give you an idea of the scale, you know, you're talking a storm double the size of Central Park moving at 55 miles an hour. So it was very difficult to really understand the boundaries of the storm as compared to, say, your typical tornado, something you can see, that classic kind of V-shape, cone shape. This one was more like a blob sitting on the ground. The entire storm system had literally sat on the ground, and it was, again, unlike anything anybody had experienced at the time.
Wow. Well, let's talk about the Beowulf analogy. I know you're using that as part of your story. For those listeners that don't know the story, can you give us a quick synopsis of that?
Sure. Yeah. So the story of Beowulf and how it relates to this particular piece that Brian and I did is the fact that we looked at Beowulf and the story of Beowulf and our spring storm system, and we looked at Mother Nature in May in particular, how she brings all these different types of weather events to us. She can bring a sunny day, she can bring a storm, and sometimes on occasion, you know, we get a tornado. Mm-hmm. And so the allegory compared to Beowulf, the mother is Mother Nature, Grendel is the tornado, and then, of course, Beowulf, who traveled great distance to do battle with Grendel, is the storm chasers. And, you know, being in Oklahoma and you being an Okie, you know as well as I do that every May and June, Oklahoma is a hotbed for storm chasers. They come from all over the country, indeed all over the world, to get a look at these storms, and sometimes they get a little too close. It's always a risk chasing a storm.
Of course.
And so right after this storm happened, maybe two or three days later, Chris was there on the ground collecting bits and pieces of Tim and Paul Samaras's Chevy Cobalt. Chris was right there days after, helping to build a little memorial on the side of the road, and he just wanted to visit the site because he is a storm buff, and he was keeping close track of that tornado. It came 11 days after the famous Moore tornado. One thing I'd like to say about the analogy is, just as in the story of Beowulf, every spring, these small Danish, these small Scandinavian towns have to suffer the threat of this great monster. That's what the poem is basically about. So every spring, these small towns are scared for their lives, and they know that they don't know when it's going to happen, but they know the monster Grendel is going to roll through and kill a bunch of people. Well, and that's where the allegory really came from, was these small Oklahoma towns sort of existing in a state of fear and uncertainty, you know, wondering what's going to happen every year. And then just a few months maybe after that tornado, the animated feature starring Angelina Jolie that was called Beowulf came out, and I just remember getting a call from Chris, Haas, you gotta watch this weird, new, very violent, animated Angelina Jolie movie that just came out. It tells the story of Beowulf and Grendel, and it reminds me of the El Reno tornado. So, I mean, Chris really was simmering and thinking about this idea and talking about this idea for about 5 years. I mean, directly, that's where we came up with the allegory in some ways, was just watching that animated feature. And, you know, Chris is a creative person, imaginative person, and so he came up with that correlation 4 to 5 years ago.
So you guys are using mixed media with this. You're using film. You're using music. Mm-hmm. There's no one really acting except for Anna Berry, Tulsa's own Anna Berry.
True.
Who's an actress. And what's her role?
The mother of Grendel. She plays Mother Nature. We're just calling her the mother. She sort of acts as our narrator or our Greek chorus in a way, in that a lot of the vantage point from how the story is being told is sort of from her vantage point. She sort of gives the viewer the introduction into the allegory, into the story that we're telling.
Yeah, indeed. She is the one who really starts the movie off, essentially letting the audience know what they are about to see and what to expect. Just as you would think, if you really had a conversation with Mother Nature, asked her to, you know, be able to control or stop something. Again, that's not what she does. Her role as, again, a creator of weather patterns and the like is to create, but not to control. And so we thought it was an interesting take on this story, just from that vantage point.
Brian, tell us about the music you're composing and mixing it with the storm footage. How was that to do as a musician?
Super unique. I've never done anything like it. Super humbling. I mean, I'm really intending this to be a requiem for the four storm chasers that died that day. This is the first time in the history of storm chasing that any storm chasers have died chasing a tornado was the El Reno tornado. So we're at the five-year anniversary. It's been intense, humbling, and beautiful. These storms are incredibly gorgeous to look at and to behold. They're so awe-inspiring, even just looking at other people, you know, looking at the storm chaser footage that we're using. I mean, it shifts your nervous system because these things are so unearthly. We've almost gotten used to hearing about them here in Oklahoma, but these storm chasers were getting way too close, and I'm not used to seeing what these people were seeing. I mean, what I'm composing directly to an amalgamation of storm chaser footage that Chris Large and Sasha Thomas are carefully and beautifully putting together in an elegant way.
So you're watching the film and
I'm sitting there with
the
my iPad on the piano watching their newest version. We've got eight total pieces, eight total songs, and I'm sitting there actually putting pencil to paper while I'm watching this footage and while I'm watching their loosely constructed narrative. I mean, we're telling the story of the El Reno tornado from beginning to end using this amalgamation of storm chaser footage.
Let me ask you this. How would you describe the music? Is it operatic? Is it jazz?
It's so all over the place, partly because I'm having to draw on all of my influences in order to keep the music exciting, because so much of it is composing to storms. I'm having to really dig deep as a composer and really dig into all different genres in order to make my musical narrative match the narrative of the tornado itself. It's been very challenging for me as a composer. Luckily, I've got Chris Combs playing the music, Annie Ellicott, and a great special guest. And all three of them I've been playing with for years and years. And then I'll be on grand piano and also the Circle Cinema's original 1928 pipe organ. I mean, I've got a lot of little secret weapons at my disposal. I'm still really concerned and curious to see how it turns out Saturday night. For me as a composer, it's a risky endeavor. I'm excited by it.
Well, let me ask you guys this. And we talked about it a little earlier. You're describing this as a requiem and a remembrance. Go ahead and elaborate on that. What do you mean by that?
Not just storm chasers died that day. I mean, I think the total number is 22 died, 23 died. I'd have to look it up again. I've read so many different stats. And probably 100 injured. I mean, it affected a lot of lives. We're directly referencing the people who lost their lives that day, including the four storm chasers. And so in it being a requiem, and it's the five-year anniversary, our attitude about this is one of being in memoriam, like in memory of the event, in memory of the people that were affected.
First and foremost, absolutely. Just to elaborate on what Brian is saying, you know, we're paying homage to the storm chaser. These men and women go out there in the springtime, sometimes throughout the year, a lot of times for, you know, no money, just out there gathering data, taking photos, taking video, and doing this for the really the love of it, and or the science of it,
and to save lives. They're out there to do preemptive research to try
saving
to figure
lives.
Out early warning research is why Tim and Paul Samaras and Carl Jung died.
Indeed,
because they were getting too close, trying to employ instruments that can help with early warning that can help save lives. That's why those three famous storm chasers died. They were in the throes of research and didn't know what they were dealing with. The tornado was so big.
And he brings up a very good point. That was a shock to everybody that was the group that got hit. Tim Samaras was considered very safe, very cautious, you know, when he chased storms. He was always one to say, and from what I've heard, is that you've always got to have a plan B. You've got to have an escape, you know, option to get out of the way of this thing because, you know, again, they were trying to get as close as possible to the tornado to put down their probes. And what they were trying to do, again, gathering this data, very valuable data, in the hopes of saving lives, to better understand how and why storms like this form. And so when it started to, you know, trickle out that this was the team that got hit, it was a huge shock to the storm chaser community and to the science community. You know, Tim was, you know, a National Geographic researcher. He was star of Storm Chasers on Discovery Channel. He was a very well-known person in this field. Again, you know, to Brian's point, this is the group that we've focused on. Their bravery, what they were doing that day was something that we can't say enough about.
When he was chasing with his son, and that's come up many times, no father would knowingly put his son in any kind of danger. They were completely taken surprise by the path of the tornado. The onboard tornado radars that these people were using during that time, the onboard in-the-car radars that the chasers were using during that time, had a five-minute lag. That's well documented. It's been in multiple articles. There was a true five-minute lag. That was part of how they were killed. They were still looking at where the tornado was 5 minutes ago when they were hit by the tornado. They were taken by surprise.
Right. It did something that most tornadoes that we get don't behave this way. Most of them, you know, move from south to east. This one kind of started to the north and headed directly south halfway through its life and then decided to make a hard left turn and then started heading northeast. And again,
it was
there were so many things that were happening. It was growing in size. It was gaining speed, and it switched directions all within a matter of minutes.
It wasn't like it was growing slowly. We've watched it. It was actually growing. When it grew very quickly, right. And suddenly you had a 4.3 wide mesocyclone sitting on the ground, sending out subvortices. Each one of these subvortices being about a mile wide, which is how big the Moore tornado was 11 days before.
Right.
And I mean, speaking to that, that's why we have so much great storm chaser footage to pull from. It's 11 days after Moore, there were about 1,000 storm chasers on the ground representing 60 different countries.
Wow.
In researching this, we also found out this storm was so large, it was almost like a carousel, if you could think of it that way, where you had this large cloud that was rotating and then these small sub-vortices that were kind of dancing around on the ground, some being, you know, 100 yards wide, some being a mile wide. Through the research that we had done, we had found out that Richard Henderson, an amateur storm chaser, the first gentleman to unfortunately die of this storm, was hit by a sub-vortices, and almost 45 seconds later, the same sub-vortices that hit Richard Henderson is the sub-vortices that hit the TwistX crew, Tim Samaras, Paul Samaras, and Carl Jung. So it essentially was not the large
body
mass.
It wasn't the large body.
It wasn't
the
large tornado that got him. It was one of those sub-vortices that, again, if you were underneath this storm, under that four to four mile range of this storm, one of those vortices could come down, and apparently that's what happened.
Well, hey, I want to get to a little bit more of the music. I'm fascinated by the fact that you're playing this old pipe organ at the Circle Cinema, a wind instrument.
Uh-huh.
Think about it.
Yep.
For a wind event.
Absolutely.
Tell me about the organ. Tell me about
It's super unique. It was the organ that was there when they built Circle Cinema in 1928. Then at some point, the cinema came under some sort of financial distress, and the Scottish Rite Masons, you can see their building off of I-44, they purchased the entire pipe organ. They were going to set it up in their grand hall, never did, and it sat there for years. And then when the Circle Cinema was starting to revitalize, somebody mentioned, hey, I think the organ's just sitting over at the Scottish Rite Masonic Temple. Sure enough, it was. They got it for a great price. And then a team of like 300 volunteers, I can't remember what exactly Chuck said, a huge team of hundreds of people devoted months to resetting it up and building it and putting it back into place at the Circle Cinema. You look down from the seating and you see keys and you see what looks like an organ. That's just the sort of appendage of the organ. The real organ is all up behind the movie screen there in theater number one. It's huge.
Sure.
There's a real glockenspiel up there, a real vibraphone up there, a real kick drum, a real snare drum, huge pipes everywhere. There's real instruments up there. When you're playing the organ, you're triggering real instruments that are up there built into the wall. Glockenspiel. There's a huge glockenspiel, a huge marimba, a huge vibraphone. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. And I'm not an organist, so that's been humbling to me as well. I'm a pianist. A lot of people know me from Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey, where I only play piano or Fender Rhodes. And I play with a band called Nola Tet, where I only play, you know, mostly grand piano. And so I've just grown up on piano. Playing organ is a whole different skill set. Luckily, I've been able to practice with it a little bit. I've got my grandmother's old 1956 Hammond organ in the Jacob Fred rehearsal space, so I've been working on that a tiny bit, and I'm starting to get more of a feeling for it. But mostly I'll be leading the band from grand piano that night.
Wow.
I want to touch on something here because, I think it's unique from the standpoint that the whole reason a pipe organ was in a theater to begin with was for the silent movies.
Absolutely.
And, you know,
my grandmother used to play for all the... She was the organist in the region for silent movies, so it's really been a homecoming for me in a weird way.
It's great. You know, behind that screen, there's all these different types of noise-making instruments that they would have back there during silent films. So people would literally be back there making these sounds in addition to the organist playing. And so what we are doing, you know, almost 100 years later is the same thing. Brian is going to be looking up at a screen that really doesn't have any volume coming out of it. His music, his band's music, will provide that aspect of it. So it's interesting. We made a film that's almost a silent film without actors other than just the beginning. And so it's Brian's music that is going to really kind of help tell this story and set the mood.